Hi, and welcome back to PaleoCast. I've just gotten to the airport on this last day of our coverage of the GSA annual meeting, and I've had to cut the conference short to go join John at the Society for Vertebrate Paleontology in Los Angeles, where we'll try and continue our daily reporting. And it's felt like I've left the GSA incredibly prematurely, just as it was really starting to get into the swing of things, but fortunately I was able to get a couple of fantastic interviews to end on. I'd just like to pass on my sincere thanks to the organisers of the conference and for everyone who contributed to each episode. And I'm going to leave you all here to get on with my airport stuff, but I hope you all enjoy these really massive interviews. And as always, we'd love to hear your comments. We've got a fantastic exclusive here, hot off the press, so just remember where you heard it first. And I'll see you in Los Angeles. So I've caught up with Mark LaFlamme, Assistant Professor at Toronto University, Mississauga, and he has been looking at the Ediacaran biota. So could you tell us a little bit about these animals, these plants? What are they?
Actually, the question of what they are is pretty much one of the most exciting questions dealing with Ediacaran biota in general, because it kind of falls into one of two camps. Earlier work believed that they were all animals, and they were able to make direct links between these strange fossils we find and modern counterparts that we find in the shallow oceans around the world. But then in the mid-80s, there was a big kind of revolution that went around in which specifically Dolph Zeilacher, who was doing research to demonstrate that based on how they were preserved, based on their morphology, and various other structures like that, they were able to say that this was not animal at all. They looked nothing like animals, and they considered a whole new branch on the tree of life that was directly competing with animals. And that the fossil record of this time didn't have any evidence of fossil animals because they were either too small and not preserved. Now, I kind of fall in between these two camps. I think that the first important part is that the Ediacaran biota are not really an entity. They're not one group. They're not one clade. They're a series of independent organisms, some of which are animals. We do have strong evidence that some of these fossils are animals. A lot of them seem to be extinct lineages that were either competing with animals or very basal on the tree. And so the Ediacaran biota as a whole is this really big assemblage of some animals, some things that aren't at all related to animals, and also that the only thing that they really share is that they're all preserved in a very similar way in rocks of about the same age.
So a lot of them are preserved in what you'd call Lagerstätte, sites of special preservation, and they're majoritively soft-bodied, aren't they?
Yeah.
So how did they manage to get preserved? Because normally you only get the hard parts. Is something special going on in these places?
Definitely, yeah. And a lot of this work has come out from a lot of work that Jim Gehling was doing specifically down in South Australia in terms of looking at the interactions between microbacteria and microbiota and their relationship with the sediment in which these Ediacaran biota were living on. So if we try to go back and try to think of a world in which we don't have really any animals that are churning up the sediment, that are really digging around, we don't have any real organisms that are really specialized to be feeding off these bacterial mats, and so we have large expanses of very thick bacterial mats. And so they would be covering most of the seafloors from our shallow waters all the way down to our deep waters as well. And these are all microconsorta of different kinds of bacteria that have different types of ways of producing energy and ways of living and existing. And the interaction between these different kinds of bacteria would result in the precipitation of specific kinds of minerals, one of which it seems to be very important is the precipitation of iron oxides or iron sulfides. Our very famous one we can think of is pyrite, the fool's gold, and that these bacteria, when interacting with the sediment, would coat these organisms once they die. They would then be coated with this thin little veneer of either clays or of these rapid iron oxides that we'd be producing with them around them, and then they would lithify so they would get hard very quickly, and then they would form a mold or a cast that sediment can then be injected into, and it preserves the equivalent of an impression of a fossil as opposed to actually preserving the fossil itself. So all the Ediacarabiota are impressions. They're more closely related to a trace fossil than they are to a real fossil, like you would go to a beach and find a bone or a shell, for instance.
Does that make it harder to interpret then?
Much harder. Because we have to take this extra step of not knowing if the preservational process is either including any new data, either adding morphology or adding structures that don't actually exist, but during the preservational process it results in these kind of strange structures that we then need to interpret. Or more likely, and this is the bigger problem, is that not everything decays at the same rate, and these bacterial consortium work on different types of time frames, and so it's a constant race between having too much decay and so you lose your organism, and not fast enough precipitation of these minerals in order to coat these organisms. Because of that, it results in less and less information that's being passed into the fossil records. So we're constantly having to interpret what is missing from our fossils based on looking at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different individuals. So you combine that with the fact that they look very strange and they're constructed of morphologies that are very different than animals, and we're dealing with some very weird wonders.
So there's been more than one Ediacaran locality discovered. So I think the first one was in the 50s in Leicester, UK, Charnia.
Okay, there's probably globally there's greater than 40. I don't remember the exact numbers of how many, but there's quite a few, which is really interesting because you would almost think that they should be exceptionally rare. You don't find them very often, but we do. We find them on almost every continent, except for Antarctica kind of thing. We do find them, all these fossils preserved at the same age, these Ediacaran fossils. So we have about upwards of 40 of these different localities. What happens, though, is that most of these are preserving very, very, very few fossils and very limited in terms of what fossils you find, very low diversity. Now, other than that, there's four main places in the world where people typically work. Mistaken Point on the east coast of Newfoundland has been very, very popular, and because they preserve entire census populations on big, large bedding plains, making it very easy. So you can walk out to something the size of a tennis court, for instance, and see tons of fossils, hundreds if not thousands of fossils there. The one locality you were talking about in South Australia that was from the late 40s that Red Sprigg was finding. So he was one of the first ones to find these localities in Australia. And actually, I should take that back. The locality in Charnwood that you're talking about, that was from Ford's work back in the 50s as well.
All right.
And so during this time period between the 40s and the 50s, there was quite a few different independent working groups that were all finding these Ediacaran fossils. But if you go back in the record even more, down in Namibia, for instance, a lot of these fossils were being found in the late 30s, early to mid-30s, actually even earlier than that, probably late 20s, early 30s. And the thing is that they weren't certain they were the right age. They thought because they were so complex, because they were so, they looked like animals, they said, well, these rocks can't be Precambrian, they must be Cambrian in age. So these earlier taxa and these earlier finds were actually predate these other locations, but we got the date wrong, and so we didn't know how important they were. And if you can go even further back than that, in the late, the mid to late 1880s, was a lot of the work by Billings in Canada, and he found some of these fossils in downtown St. John's, Newfoundland. So you can actually go, and it's still there. You go, it's a parking lot, it's right across the street from a Tim Hortons, so all the Canadians know all about it, and they can walk out there, and every year we have a conference in Newfoundland. You'll always find a bunch of geologists out in this parking garage, this parking lot, pulling out little fossils that they can still find there from this type location.
And so with 40 different locations, are they all the same style of preservation, this molds and casts?
Not entirely. The mold and cast is really the majority of the way we find these Ediacaran fossils, but each individual site has very different peculiarities that kind of go with it. In terms of overall preservation, sometimes we find them as 3D molds, and so we can actually see them preserved in three dimension, and that one is very difficult because we have to find a way of getting sediment into the skeletons of these organisms, right? These soft tissue organics of this. We have to find a way of getting sediment in there to allow them to be preserved in three dimensions. So that's very strange. The stuff in Newfoundland that I worked on, it's all preserved from the casting effects on volcanic ash. So even though we have bacteria there, they were probably they were much more reduced because they couldn't use sunlight as their primary source of energy because we were dealing with deeper water environments. So down there, we had the interaction between bacteria that weren't reliant on sunlight, they were reliant on other forms of nutrients, and they would be interacting probably in some way, shape, or form with the volcanic ash as it came down to allow the volcanic ash to become hard and lithify very quickly to save these casts in a similar manner as the ones we see in Australia and other places as well, too. So what is interesting is there are so many different modes of preservation, and some of my work has been targeting the same species across different modes of preservation, and that's really, really getting some interesting ideas because the striking thing is something we had touched on earlier on was that each of these preservational modes has different information that is being preserved within different morphological information is being preserved, and so it's only by looking across all these different preservational ways that we were able to get a complete understanding of an organism, and so it really gives us faith that we're going to have to start doing this a lot more and in comparing these different fossils from different sites.
So the taxa that go between sites, are they? Do you get many cosmopolitan ones that are just everywhere, and do you just get some that are just restricted to the one locality?
Yeah, you get both. So it's very similar to, you know, a modern biological system, right? So some of these fossils that we have very, very long temporal distributions. So they're found in some of the earliest Ediacaran sections and some of the latest Ediacaran sections. But also they tend to have very global distributions. Some of these taxa are found globally, long time frames. They're found in shallow waters and deep waters. So clearly these were organisms that were very much generalist, that pretty much could live anywhere. Then we have some very specialized groups that we only know from specific environments now. So that we find them globally or in one or two different locations once you find the same environmental setting that we're looking for, either shallow waters or deep waters or something like that. And some other are known only from one location. And what's strange is when they tend to be incredibly diverse or very prolific in these one locations, and then we don't see them anywhere else. So there's clearly a certain benefit for them being endemic to that one area and really dominating that ecosystem. But for some reason, we don't find them anywhere else. And why we don't find them is still an ongoing question as much as why do we find them.
So talking of ongoing questions, what's really left to discover about the Ediacaran fauna? Is it really Everything.
I'm certain every discipline feels that way. There's constant progress. And I think what's really interesting is there's a lot of new directions of study that are going on. Certain questions seem to be very important. This preservation question is becoming more and more important. And so we see multiple different independent working groups that are tackling this question from different facets. Either people that are decaying organisms in a laboratory setting to see this, people who are doing exhaustive work on an outcrop to look at these different preservational styles. So a lot of really good work being combined from different labs. The big question, I think, is still what are they and where do they fit in the tree of life? And a lot of really good people are doing that work, specifically from both the grassroots work of identifying these fossils, figuring out the relationships amongst these individual fossils, and to know how many different groups of organisms we have at this time, in addition to those who are doing the more stand-back work, which is, now that we understand the hierarchy within these individual groups, where do these groups fit in the larger tree of life? Are they related to animals? Are they not related to animals? Are they an offshoot before or after kind of situation? So there's multiple different questions, and the ones that interest me the most are definitely the preservation and where they fit in the tree of life, but that's only a few of where other people are doing a lot of great work.
Is there anywhere where our audience could follow your work online?
Yeah, there's a lot of really cool resources online. I know various museums will have their own sections of Ediacaran fossils that you can find there. And so they'll have some dioramas in which you can see some good interpretations of which areas you have. I personally don't have a website, really. I have a work website, but I don't have one for Ediacaran fossils. But it's definitely something we're hoping to do, mostly because the Royal Ontario Museum has a beautiful, beautiful website for the Burgess Shale. And once I saw that, I was like, oh, Jean-Bernard, we need to do this for the Ediacaran biota. So maybe tell your audience to keep an eye out for it. It'd be great if the Royal Ontario Museum could be able to do something like that as well, too. But right now, In terms of great places to go, I know that Gnarbon's site at the Queen's University, they have a good section on the Idiakaride biota and stuff like that. And actually, a lot of the Wikipedia entries are actually quite good as well, too, for the different individual taxa and locations around the world.
Mark Lafon, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
After lunch, our new Paleocast groupie, Ali Baumgartner, managed to beg us an interview with a man who needed no introduction. In fact, that's just as well. The discussion started so quickly that I never got a chance for introductions. And by the time I had my recorder out, we were well into the conversation, and so that's where we jumped right in. We were later joined by Matt Mossbrooker, director of the Morrison Natural History Museum and lead researcher of this project, who gave us further details. But for now, the audio you're about to hear is going in unedited, so we bring to you the one, the only, the legend, Bob Bakker.
What have you heard?
I was told that Brontosaurus is not actually a thing. It was like it was the parts of different dinosaurs, and that the Apatosaurus is probably a better vacation.
That's totally wrong, but that's widely believed.
Okay, well,
yes.
That's better, I guess.
Widely believed.
At least I, with the majority?
If you go out here to a school, second, third, fourth graders, and you start talking about Brontosaurus, they will frown at you because they've been told, as you have heard, that Brontosaurus does not exist. It's been expunged, that it was some terrible mishmash of the head of one animal and the body of another. It was a chimera. And that, in fact, it ought not to be used, the word Brontosaurus. In fact, you've got to use the word Apatosaurus, which is taxonomically pure. And if you heard all of those things, every single thing you have heard is wrong. Totally wrong.
Okay, so what's going on? Should we be thinking of Brontosaurus then? What's the difference?
Apatosaurus was the first big long-necked dinosaur found, a good specimen anywhere in the world, 1877, right over there, half an hour away, little town of Morrison. It now has 434 people in it. In 1877, it had 435 people. Was also the locus of the first Jesuit university in Colorado, which has nothing whatever. Actually, it does have something to do with dinosaurs, because they were involved in the excavation of beautiful red rock building stone. And then the Jesuits left, and the theological rating of the whole town went down several notches. Anyway, 1877, Arthur Lakes, who was an Episcopalian, lay minister, was looking for something that could be sold and make money, like gravel, like coal. Coal is good. Building stone, maybe. And instead he found these ginormous bones, huge, like twice as big as any bones had ever been found before. So he sends off telegrams and samples to two guys, two paleontologists, Professor Marsh at Yale, Bula Bula, my alma mater, whose motto is lax et vanitas, I think, which means laziness brings truth, something like that. Anyway, and the second group of fossils went to Professor Cope, a Quaker, interesting guy. The leader of the Neo-Lamarckians, which has something to do with European currency, Lamarck, Deutschmark, something, I don't know, I'm confused. Anyway, so these two guys, two professors who hated each other, by the way, at that time, get samples of the world's largest bones. Marsh sent back a check. Smart. Arthur Lakes, the lay Episcopalian, remember he is Episcopalian, minister, starts digging these things, and brilliant field geologist, because all of his sections, all of his diagrams are in color. He brought out his watercolors, so you can get every one of his bones from 1877, see exactly in the cliff where it was found. Fabulous. Anyway, he finds four skeletons. Four. Please note, make a note that the professor's holding up four fingers. And he sends them back. And everyone goes, wow, and it's named Apatosaurus. And it's a damn good type sample, damn good. And he has the back of the head, he has a lot of the neck, the body, the legs, front and hind, lots of the tail. And it's just, it's not only huge, it's just massive, massively muscled. It's arguably the strongest dinosaur, not the heaviest, but its muscle mass per unit body weight is really high. Anyway, so that's Apatosaurus. He didn't get the front of him, the skull, didn't get the snout. We didn't know at the time, he didn't know at the time that the snout evolves really fast because it's used for making noise, like the honking of a goose. Have you ever been attacked by a goose? You ever heard a goose honk?
I've heard honking. One honk. I've not been attacked by one.
No, I can arrange that. We didn't know. No one knew at the time that the snout of dinosaurs evolves really fast. You know about duckbills. They come in a zillion different crest types, and the crests are hollow, and they're musical instruments. Same thing with these long necks. But no one knew it at the time. The snout was missing. Big deal. Meanwhile, two years later, another party from Professor Marsh at Yale, Bula Bula Lex at Vanitas, finds a single skeleton, not four, a single skeleton, in Como Bluff, Wyoming. Very similar to a apatosaurus, a little more delicate, a little more graceful, but damn good. And Marsh had brilliant scientific artists who produced a complete drawing of the skeleton, several, which made headlines worldwide because it was a visual, you know. Here's a visual. And it got repeated and repeated and repeated in newspapers and kids' books. Anyway, Brontosaurus became famous because of the marketing and the art. Marketing and art. It's like Julia Roberts, same thing. Anyway, delicate boned, you know, marketing. The New York Museum got a skeleton, which they called Brontosaurus, and mounted in New York, and it's been seen by more people than any other long-necked skeleton. And the Chicago Museum got one. A bunch of people got it. Brontosaurus was the long-necked dinosaur. Immense vertebra. Wins the award for having the widest neck vertebra. So growing up in the 50s, it was Brontosaurus. And it's in the first movie of Lost World, 1925, silent movie.
I've got it.
I've seen it. Do you have the director's cut that shows the making of the stop frame animation sculptures?
I'm not sure. I'd have to check on that.
Oh, it's wonderful. You can actually see the sculptor making the stop frame Brontosaurus. And the science in 1925 in the movie is better than the science in museums. In museums, they have the poor Brontosaurus stuck up to its armpits in a fetid swamp. But in the movie, it's moving in mixed herds of other long necks. And in the movie, it's quite a vengeful vegisaur. When attacked by an allosaur, it counterattacks and throws the allosaur off a cliff. It's very dramatic, leading to the slogan, vegisaurs rule. Anyway, so most people, not all, but most people grew up believing Brontosaurus was the king of the long-necked dinosaurs, including me. But there was a minority of these eggheads who said, no, wait a minute. Apatosaurus is 2 years older as a name. Four good specimens. We know what it was shaped. If you look at the shoulders, you look at the pelvis, it's like Brontosaurus. It's so much like it. If you had them alive today in a zoo, they'd be two different species of the same genus. And so the academic pointy heads arguing Brontosaurus exists as a species of Apatosaurus. Species of Apatosaurus. Now, there was a mix-up on... And the heads has nothing whatever to do with Brontosaurus, Apatosaurus. Professor Marsh put several different... He didn't have a head for Brontosaurus. He put several different heads on, trying them out. They weren't from the same quarry. They weren't from the same level of rock. They weren't from the same species or genus or family. It would be like taking, a giraffe head and putting it on your goat. Or actually the other way around, putting a goat head on your giraffe. It has nothing whatever to do with which name are you going to use. If these are two species that are very similar, they belong under one genus. I like she's nodding. And she gives good noddies. You English, if you're a TV producer, you want noddies. You know, David Attenborough. We're standing here today in the hallroom of the Geological Society of America. And if we're very, very quiet, we might hear the male paleontologist giving his throat display. Ah, there it is. Anyway,
I can tell that that's not the first time you've done your David Attenborough impersonation.
I worked with him. He did a four-part series on paleontology, and he's a great guy to work with because he cut his chops. He was a zoo director for his first couple of years. He's a very good zoologist. I named a plesiosaur for him, Attenboroughsaurus, because when he was a wee little kid, his favorite museum had Jurassic sea monsters, sea reptiles. And there was one that, alas, got blown up in the war. Damn crowds. And HE-111s, I believe. Don't get me started. But they have a very good plaster cast of this. It was a fairly long-necked plesiosaur with a massive muzzle. That's the type of Attenboroughsaurus, plaster type, because of the krauts. Don't mention the war, by the way. Mm-hmm. Don't mention. It's very faulty towers. Meets Jurassic Park here, isn't it?
Sybil. Yes, Manuel. Where were we? I got lost.
I got lost as well.
Cool. Anyway, so there was a minority of taxonomic lawyers saying that you can't use the name Brontosaurus. The animal exists, but it's a species of Apatosaurus. In the 1970s, Jack McIntosh, who was a theoretical physicist who loves giant dinosaurs, had figured out that the bits and pieces found in 1877 were Apatosaurus skull, and that another skull found in Dinosaur National Monument in Utah, where the coffee is really awful, by the way, in Utah. You know that, right? If you're are you a Mormon?
No, I'm not.
Oh,
I just
don't
drink
say
coffee.
It that way, as if it's a bad thing. What do you have against Mormon people? Is it the thin dark ties and the white shirts and cheap black jackets at the missionaries?
No problems with Mormons. I've been to their tabernacle. It's beautiful.
Really?
Yeah, before it was closed to the public.
Don't you find the outer architecture a little Disneyland meets...
Well, yeah, but I got to go inside and it was beautiful and no one else, you can't do that anymore, so I feel kind of important.
Oh, okay. Anyway... Where were we? Oh, Utah. There was in Pittsburgh, there's a wonderful skeleton of an apatosaur. And they didn't know they had a complete head. They didn't know. It had been found very nearby, but because there was so much confusion about what kind of head are you going to put on it, they didn't know that they had the head. The head's tiny for the size of the animal, and delicate and pointy. Not like Julia Roberts, more like Keira Knightley. Very delicate, S-shaped neck. How does she hold her skull on her neck? Do you know?
I have no idea.
I mean, that's one of the thinnest, most swan-necked. It's interesting. Good actress, though. Yeah, that Jane Austen movie she did? The best Jane Austen movie. But we digress. Anyway, so in the 1970s, the news was dropped that actually we had the skull of Apatosaurus in 1877. We had a complete skull from Utah since 1909, and it was this pointy little delicate skull. That's a separate story from the name Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus, right? Okay. So by 1980, most of us professional paleontologists, since we have to get certified with our PhDs and get our union card, we had to adhere to the taxonomic lawyer's judgment that Brontosaurus is a species of Apatosaurus. So you have Apatosaurus ajax, first species, and Apatosaurus excelsus, the species that was used to name Brontosaurus. Okay. So kids got this garbled message. They coalesced. Can we use the word coalesced? Are these literate people I'm talking to? How about palimpsest? Can we talk about a palimpsest? Do they know that's not a form of perversion? Do they? Seriously.
You know
what a palimpsest is.
No.
No? You know what a palimpsest is.
So.
Palimpsest is very interesting from paleontology. Palimpsest means, the original meaning is a document. You write something, maybe on a stone tablet or a parchment. And later on, someone scrapes your message off, writes on top of it, because stones and parchment was expensive. If you can read the original message through the second one, that's a palimpsest. And so peering through layers of erasure. Has nothing to do with Keira Knightley. Anyway. Do you need to take a minute? Do you need a sandwich? Can I help you?
Dear.
Anyway, kids' writers garbled it, and what you just expressed to me is this garbled palimpsest thing, two totally separate issues. What does the head look like in Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus? And we had it wrong. And is Brontosaurus different enough to be not only a different species, but a different genus? And so it was until a couple months ago, when the little tiny Morrison Museum, remember Morrison at the time, 435, there's an unsolved mystery about Morrison. It was a guy that no one liked who was on his wagon driving from Morrison to Denver, and someone shot him in the back with a shotgun, both barrels. Don't know. Anyway, the Jesuits left. Did we have that down? Okay. Are you going to edit this?
No, I think it's best if we leave it entirely unedited.
Do not read, speaking about Jesuits, Teilhard de Chardin, the great paleontologist. brilliant. He did the mapping, 3D mapping of the Homo erectus site near Beijing, the so-called Peking Man. He did it. Just brilliant field geologist, good anatomist. But when he tried philosophy, the phenomenon of man is phenomenally unreadable. Don't pick it up. Everyone read it in the 60s, but we were doing various drugs. Anyway, so that was the terrible confusion. And people got very angry because people liked the word brontosaurus. Beautiful. It's melodic. Thunder lizard. Which is totally misleading because the feet are padded. If you look at the footprints, are padded. Have you ever been in a camp in Africa when elephants move through?
No.
Can't hear them. They're padded feet. You cannot hear them. They give off no impact. You can smell them. Cannot. Actually, their poop doesn't smell bad. Pretty good digestion. We could diverge into who farts more, Allosaurus or Brontosaurus. These plant-eating dinosaurs have huge rib cages. That's how you tell a plant eater from a meat eater, by the size of the rib cage. Because to digest plant fiber, you need lots of microbes and vats. Have you ever lit a cow fart? You're a city boy, aren't you?
I'm a city boy, yes.
Have you ever lit a cow fart?
No, I haven't.
Cows fart continuously, right. But you can't smell it because it's extremely efficient digestion. And when you light it, you get a clean blue flame from the methane. Well, if you lit a brontosaurus, it would be like that. They have big guts, right? Big guts. Hay burners. Although there's no hay in the Jurassic because that's a flowering plant. There are no flowers until the Cretaceous. Anywho, so people got upset. Kids got upset. And lay people got upset when the word brontosaurus, so melodic, so evocative, was erased. Anyhow, the town of Morrison has a museum, which is called the Morrison Museum. And they have salvaged huge blocks of rock from the layer of rock that gave us the first Apatosaurus. And there are bones in those blocks of rock, but the rock is harder than granite, and the bones are delicate. So if you whack at it with a chisel, the bone falls apart and the rock remains. This is very depressing. Not this interview, but watching the bones just crumble. The Morrison Museum, however, acquired they're really micro jackhammers, called air scribes, that produce a very precise vibration. So you can remove the rock grain by grain by grain under high power. And guess what they found? As you've been following this narrative, what do you really want to find from Apatosaurus, the original 1877 long neck? What was missing? Have you been paying attention? Exactly, yes. He's not as drug-addled as you indicated to me you thought he was. Yeah, they found exactly what had been missing, the snout. Wow, okay, that's cool. And they've cleaned it all by themselves, a museum that's 1.5 paid employees, visitorship about 13,000, but real good with kids. I participated a little bit, but mostly Matt Mossbrucker did the work. And it just emerged, snout. A couple years before that, my crew had found a brontosaurus in Wyoming. Very good skull snout. It looked pretty normal, pretty much like Diplodocus, which is also pronounced Diplodocus or Diplodocus, which is correct. I haven't a clue, don't care. That's another whole thing. Anyway, so they're emerging under the skilled fingertips of the Morrison Museum.
I offer a gold coin for interrupting you.
Thank you.
You don't do that. You don't walk into an interview, fella. I almost punched him out. Flattened him. I'm from Jersey. We punch people out.
And the coins aren't all that good either.
No, yeah, we got some chocolate coins.
The milk chocolate. It's Hershey's milk chocolate. Jane chocolate. Oh, I'm Dutch. I'm used to Dutch chocolate. Anyway, let's stay on here. Let's stay on the narrative here. Forget about those things. So we had a skull of Brontosaurus excelsus, pretty normal-looking skull. And then the snout of Apatosaurus emerges. There was a poster session on it, first poster session of GSA. And people's jaws dropped, those who knew dinosaur skulls, because it's weird. Apatosaurus, Brontosaurus belong to the Diplodocus family. Pretty big family, but all their heads look more or less the same. They have a hole here between eye and nostril. Birds have that.
It's part of the birdness in dinosaurs. And in life, it had been full of hair. Makes the snout lighter. It's usually about, I don't know, about that big.
Well, the size of an egg.
Let's see. That's about the size...
Baseball.
It's a funny-shaped baseball. I don't know. It's this big. It's this about the size of your fuzzy little friend here. But the Apatosaurus, it was twice as big. Same overall size, but twice as big. A huge square thing, which would make the snout incredibly light. The snout looks like a saxophone reed. It's designed to vibrate, clearly. It's very loosely connected to the rest of it. It's going to vibrate. Okay. So here's the Apatosaurus, which is a really massive, remember I said it was really massive, strong guy? It's the snout that vibrates. Whereas Brontosaurus is kind of a more normal snout. It's going to vibrate a little bit. So if you time travel, if you get a Jurassic TARDIS and go to the... they're making a lot of money with that. I wonder who has the copyright for the original Doctor Who.
BBC? I don't know.
No. I don't think so. Anyway, if you time travel back to the late Jurassic and you listen to... You record in a bull Brontosaurus, you'd hear this deep infrasound. Probably go so deep you'd feel it through your feet. And you go over and record an Apatosaurus, it'd be a way different sound. It'd be much higher frequency. Heavier animal, but a much higher frequency call. These animals that we had thought were really closely related aren't. The Apatosaurus had diverged way off sideways into left field. And there's no question whatever that Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus are not the same. If they were alive today, a good zookeeper would have a separate label for them. They would act differently. Apatosaurus is much the stronger of the two, but a higher pitched vibration. And that's cool. That's cool. I'm going to eat my sandwich now.
We'll go with that. So I'm Matt Mossbrecker with the Morrison Natural History Museum, located at the type section of the Morrison Formation in Morrison, Colorado. Morrison. Essentially, what we've been doing for the past decade is we've reopened the historic dig sites where the first Stegosaurus and the first Apatosaurus were dug up. Genome holotypes. So these are the conceptual blueprints for these iconic dinosaurs. And through some very patient preparation endeavors, we have uncovered evidence that both Stegosaurus armatus and Apatosaurus ajax are...
Nothing much, you know.
Weird. We don't understand these animals. They are very odd animals because our conception of Stegosaurus, our perception of Stegosaurus, is based on other skeletons, referred specimens, Stegosaurus synops, found in Garden Park, Colorado, same year. Mostly complete skeleton, wonderful beast. But when we look at the tail of the genome holotype and we compare it to the tail of all other Stegosaurus, with the exception of Stegosaurus ungulatus, there are some novel characteristics that we see and our armatus to a point where there's nothing quite like it. More on that later. Apatosaurus, that's the reason why I'm here today, is Apatosaurus. Apatosaurus ajax was first collected in a little pond by Arthur Lakes. Over the span of 2 years and 2 months, he and his crew collected two animals from the site, but the genome holotype of Apatosaurus ajax was segregated at a lower clay bed. One animal there, one animal only. It's a young individual, only three sacral vertebrae. The scap coracoid, the shoulders are unfused, bones are smooth. It's a young guy. Our weight estimates place it at 80,000 pounds, or eight female Asian elephants duct taped together. Duct tape is not a part of that calculation, by the way. The animal's about as long as three city buses. It's a giant dinosaur. Femur goes 2,030 millimeters, at least. And they did find, back in 1877, with the type specimen of Apatosaurus, a brain case in paraquadrates. They ended up at Yale. Marsh didn't put that brain case on Apatosaurus ajax, and you know what? Nobody would have. And here's the reason why. This brain case is not much larger than your fist. So clench your fist, look at your fist. Not terribly big, right? Look at your thumb. That's about the size of the cranial endocast, so that's where the brain would go. And That modest lump of bone, which was incomplete, by the way, it was partially broken or maybe chewed off. Well, it belonged to this animal that had a giant linebacker-like neck. The neck was twice as wide as it is deep at the base. It had an architecture unlike any other apatosaurine. Even today, we don't know of another apatosaurine that has a neck quite like Apatosaurus ajax. It's a bizarre animal. I wouldn't have put the pinhead on the linebacker neck either. Fast forwarding a little bit to 2003, our little teaching museum that started a field research program to better understand what was living in Morrison and how things came to be buried. Well, we were alerted to what were thought at that time to be crocodile teeth at Morrison's Quarry 5, Stegosaurus dig site. And popped over, took a look at the teeth, and realized instantly that, wow, these are not crocodile teeth. Enamel's too thin, teeth are too long, too skinny, too cylindrical. And you know what these look like? Diplodocine teeth. So we figured that we couldn't determine if they were true diplodocines or apatosaurines just by looking at the teeth. I'm not sure if anybody can, honestly. And except for Bob. Bob might be able to. And because he knows these things. And we took these specimens back to the museum for conservation because they were in a big ex situ boulder. And we had to wait for 8 years to start preparing the samples because the sandstone is like concrete. It is really, really hard. And this hard concrete is enveloping bones that are silicified to a point where it's like trying to clean a Fabergé egg, a porcelain doll, out of a block of concrete. Consequently, old air scribes produce too much vibration, too high of a frequency, and they would shatter the bones if you touch the scribe to the rock, or pretty dang close, if they even broke the rock at all. I don't know of a harder sandstone around Jurassic bone. But we waited until a German dentist in his garage engineered, I'm not kidding, little hand tools that run at low air pressure, and with such a fine action, you know, German engineering, it's a thing. These guys, these tools, these HW60s and this fleet that Hardy Winkler have engineered have allowed us to clean Stegosaurus and begin cleaning this apatosaur. We've come to find it's an apatosaur based upon the robustness of the dental margins kind of squared off. The area underneath the air pocket is deep. It's like every other apatosaur, sample size of two. And unlike other diplodocines, we're pretty sure it's an apatosaurine, and the anorbital fenestra, the window in front of the eye, it's really big, it's expanded. It's an apatosaurine in overall geometry, morphology, but it's not like Apatosaurus louisi from Dinosaur National Monument or the Tate Museum's Bronto excelsis skull, Apatosaurus excelsis. Not quite like that. It's something unique. And it does match. It's derived. And it kind of matches the oddly derived brain case of Apatosaurus ajax too. But here's the funny thing. We just learned this last week. From Quarry 5, there was a diplodocine that was named. And that animal is called Diplodocus lacustris, kind of named in passing in 1884. And those teeth actually belong to our partial skull. Left maxilla, left premaxilla, and part of the right premax. Tiny little teeth packed into these jaws more than any other apatosaurine or diplodocine that we know of. By two or three tooth crown positions in the max, and by four tooth crown positions. Yes, four extra tooth crown positions in the premax. That should freak everybody out. People are saying, no! Going to have to redefine what it means to be an apatosaurine, and that's exactly where we're going with all of this. Our specimen that we've named Kevin, because it looks like a Kevin, is so weird that when you look at the original ajax, you look at its brain case, you look at its neck, you look at its hips, you look at its choice in religion, its favorite color, it's just so different compared to other apatosaurines that they certainly warrant taxonomic redefinition. And clearly where this is leading is the ancient Brontosaurus-Apatosaurus nexus. Well, 110 years ago when Elmer Riggs synonymized these two genera, he did make some valid points. They were found in the same formation. At that time, we didn't know how long it took for formations to get laid down. We didn't know how the Earth was. Those were estimates based upon sedimentation rates. And I think it would break poor Rick's brain to know that the Earth is, you know, 4.5 billion years old. I just, it's an inconceivably large number. But he was thinking, you know, maybe 200,000 to 300,000 years for the Morris, and we now know that's anywhere from 8.5 to 13.5 million years worth of time. Apatosaurus and Brontosaurus, these two samples of Excelsus and Ajax, they didn't live at the same time. Faunas seem to be different. Their heads, their necks, their hips are different too. And when I look at these specimens, I see a broader difference, I think, between apatosaurines, between these two apatosaurines than we see with an elk and deer or even modern rhinoceros genera. They're really that different. So, I mean, one's Catholic, one's Protestant. They're all just very, very different animals. So what we're attempting to do is collect a bit more data. We've got a few things to measure and micro-CT scan. We've got to get Kevin out of the block. And unless we find something contradictory, we might. Who knows? I don't have a dog in this fight yet. I haven't published it yet. We just have posters up. And people forget about posters in 10 minutes. So who knows? I mean, we might have something here.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.